an idea of outlook. I wish I could do it more in the form of my dad did. People used to tell me, my dad would walk down Franklin Avenue. In fact, many times he would go down for his own mail. The mail would be left at the post office and walk. And rather than send one of us or one of the helpers down, he would take that opportunity to go down and mail a letter and meet people. And he'd walk down one side of the street, cross the street, and walk up the next side of the street. And that tour would take him an hour and a half to 3 hours, depending on the weather, who he would meet, what have you. And if he was wanted, we could always find him somewhere on the edge. But he'd walk down the street with a smile on his face. And he had many burdens and more problems financially on the head than any person he could ever imagine. And no one knew of his personal problems. Very few. Well, he was very intimate friends. People played cards with him. They would know, or the priest would know about that. But we lost our home mainly because my dad was a good guy. And people needed a cosigner. In those days, you had to have a cosigner in order to get a loan to get a home. And my dad, being in business, would cosign them. When they couldn't pay, when the Depression hit, the cosigner was brought on deck. And he was supposed to pay off the loan. Well, in the process, we lost four pieces of property. My dad couldn't pay. We bought the downtown funeral home four times.
You lost him.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Directly across from the library, the catty corner across from the library on Franklin Avenue, 658 Franklin.
Is the building still there?
Yes. It's in a decrepit condition now because the people that bought it didn't maintain it. It became a halfway house for boys, and whoever was managing it didn't take care of it properly. And I think the contractor that remodeled had to repossess it from the state or this other party. But it was beautifully maintained, and my mother had it well. In fact, every year, besides washing down walls, we had to paint and redecorate almost every year because of the dirt in the area. And the eloquent was not the cleanest time when the plant was working. Mm-hmm. Now it's too clean and nobody's working. In 1930, I remember going on a call with my dad. Well, my mother was away. My dad was babysitting. And he had to take me out on a call in the middle of the night. And nobody couldn't get anybody to watch me, so I didn't mind it. I sat in the car in Logstown and looked at the steel plant, and there wasn't any fire, there wasn't any lights, there was one single light. And he said, you know, he just came out of a house of sadness, this colored lady who died at home. And he said, they don't have any food. We'll have to go back and bring them some food. He said, when you don't see any smoke coming out of that stack over there, you don't see any lights in the plant, there's going to be a problem. People were they were having a tough time. I don't think anybody starved in this town, but they were close to it that they didn't have two square meals a day, or maybe even one hot meal a day.
What happened when people died at that time? And what did your father and family bury?
Okay, he buried them regardless whether they had any money or not. And that was part of his downfall. He started to do all the black funerals, and we had about 85% of them. And if one paid, the other relatives would borrow more than what they paid for that. Consequently, they were being abused. The funeral directors were taking advantage of them when they had money. And then when J&L, in 36, I think it was, we got the bus service in 36, and J&L got employees insurance. And then we got two black funeral directors who came in because when someone died, they had the money.
Did your family lose that?
Oh, yes. We really didn't want to hold on to it when they got their own. We still buried a few up until about 1947, 48. Not very many. And now, if one called us, we couldn't refuse them. And that caused a lot of problems. But, in fact, a black girl called me for a job the other day. And I told her there wasn't any opening, but I asked her to send a profile on them. We would try to spread the name around, and I called the school and found out she was a good student, fine personnel. But it's tough to get a note. This girl offered to work for nothing, just to get her internship. Of course, she's local, and she could do that. But she couldn't commute, you know, a great distance. But
did people ever pay?
might have, say if they owed a small balance, say a farmer could bring in produce at the harvest time, they owed a very small. Funerals then were $150 to $350. And cemeteries, then you could get a grave for $25 and $15 open. They were looking at huge prices, $400 to $500 for the ground, and $300, $400 for open, $700, $900 for single space, plus the casket services, and flowers, clothing, all those things that make up the cost. But I don't think my dad ever accepted anything, maybe a lot. Yeah, that could be. He could have accepted some real estate. He could have accepted an automobile or something of value. But we just repossessed a car not long ago. Family couldn't pay us, and we paid them the difference. And, they owed us $1,500 and some dollars for a period of almost 11 or 12 months. We never paid anything. And then my son went down and talked to them and said, well, here's an app. You have this. And he said, there's no other way for us to collect. One man is on medical disability, a veteran. He'll be sent to a veteran's hospital. And he'll never, he's retired now, he'll never gain any more wages. He's living on Social Security. And the son is trying to start a little business, and he's having a tough time. He's also working in a steel plant, but the steel plant's cut down. So I'd say that we usually stop right here when a family comes in to make arrangements. If we find that they don't have any means to defray their expenses, we tell them to stay within reason, because we're the losers. Once we have that burial, we can't claim on our merchandise. Our services are gone. And I have a lot of loved ones out in many cemeteries where we actually got paid nothing. One lady and her attorney absolutely cheated us out of everything. It was very expensive. She wasn't honest with us. It was a common law marriage, and they had a 9-year-old child, and the child was the beneficiary of insurance. And the lady was spending insurance money that she had no title to. And then the other part of it was her attorney guaranteed a payment. The attorney, when he was confronted, said no. So the man's three brothers from Boston came down and said, you can convince this widow to turn the remains over to us, have the service here, and let us bury them in the family lot in Boston. We'll pay you everything. And I had that offered to us and couldn't accept it. The lady wouldn't agree. So I lost almost $3,900. I paid for the ground, casket, flower, and clothing, everything. So we learned lessons. Right now, if we find that a family has insurance and that they look like they're not good managers, we have them give an assignment. We never had an assignment from my dad. Never one. Now it's a common thing every 3 or 4 months. To protect us, we have to have an assignment. We don't cash advance a lot of money now. We will pay for transportation, death notices, and very minor things. We don't even pay for flowers anymore. We don't pay any cemetery charge. Because we could have $1,000 or $1,500 just in cemetery for each and every funeral. 30 of those a month, we're out $35,000, $40,000 in cash advance.
What do you mean when you say assignments?
If they have insurance, we have them make a statement on an assignment form that when that policy is sent in with the death certificate, the payment for X number of dollars will go direct to us, mm-hmm. and the balance goes to the family. In fact, there are many funeral homes that will not service a family until they're guaranteed one way or another where their funds are coming from.
When you say your dad never did that,
no.
Was it necessary or he didn't?
It was just his policy that he met a person face to face and trusted them or didn't trust them, or he would advise them to do this or do that. And some of them turned sour, some of them that were stable people, some of them didn't do that. But the economy changed and the way of doing business changed. My dad never took a salary, which was wrong. He should have taken a fee for his talent and his services, but he never took it. And consequently, he never built up any reserves. And losing things 3 or 4 times. He was a self-made man. Every time he got his back to the wall, he'd bounce back and come back stronger. And he dreamed of a building like this, and unfortunately, he didn't get to see it. But that was his idea, to have something convenient for the people and a place easier for us to live. But it might have been our inspiration up there.
You mentioned your mother, and I want to ask you, what were some of the ordinary
Well, besides raising 8 children, she always found time to help my dad when he needed help. She was always on the phone when he was out of the building. And she later, in later years, she did the hairdressing for ladies and answered the doorbell. She was more or less a host and receptionist. But not that she stood at the door 8 hours or anything like that. But when you live at the general home, just like when we were growing up, you get big enough to carry a folding chair, you're working. Always contribute, do something, one thing or another. Being the oldest, I was very privileged to be close to my dad. And we were like pals besides father and dad, father and son. But my mom was his inspiration, and every time he had a problem, he could talk it over to my mother. And she always had really good advice for him. In fact, I mentioned his politics, and his political cronies came after him. They wanted to use his popularity, his name, to get taxpayer office in Ellicottville. And they wanted him to run for tax collector. So he said, I can't give you a yes or no answer. I have to ask my partner. And they were surprised. Who's your partner? She's my wife. So they were in our home on Plant 6, and my dad excused himself, went in the kitchen, and mom was fixing supper. So you can do what you want to do, but you'll be one or the other. You can't do both. So he came back and said, no, thanks for the opportunity. And it's a good thing he did. In those days, taxes were starting to go up, and tax collector made a nice income, not much work. But he would have been more or less selling his loyalties to that party and would have to stay with him. And that's the way politics work. Well, my dad declined, and he said, no. He only knew he was the older tax collector. But the old look on a tax collector, oh, he was an ogre. He was one of those people who sell homes in order to collect them. But my mom had a good influence on him. In fact, she used to drive cars during the war. Mother was a good driver. And when we couldn't get helpers, the men would rather work in steel plant because they meant cut a tremendous amount of money. She did everything but be a pallbearer. She used to drive the hearse or the limousine with the family, like that, besides raising the family. But she was always there when it came time to decorate the funeral. She had very good taste. She decorated this building. Oh, yeah. The only thing we changed was the hallways, and we put a mural here and one in the smoking room, a few other little things. But she bought all the paintings. We still have the original carpet, 14 years old. And she didn't like it at first. She said, well, if you guys want it, go ahead. It was a bright color in those days, 14 years ago, 64. But we decided we needed something a little bit brighter, and it worked out fine. And we're getting ready to put new carpet in. They won't guarantee it over 5 years. But what we got was a very good commercial grade carpet.
You mentioned politics, too. Did you ever know of any pressure on the sisters of the priest to be
involved in this? I imagine they were approached, but I don't know of any what we call pressure. I imagine we had a lot of good Catholic people in our parish who were, by their own conviction, they were Republican. And they, in turn, might have mentioned it to the priest. But I think they were almost all of them. Priests and nuns were almost thinking along the same terms as my dad. They didn't make an X for one party when they voted. They voted for the personality, the individual, and their ability to serve that office. And that's why I feel badly about this past election. We had a good candidate that could have served everybody, and because he was one conviction, he lost. If he'd been in the other party, he might have come through winning. He wouldn't concede. He had certain ideas and convictions and his way of doing things. He doesn't regret it. He lost the election because of that. I don't know, there might have been an inclination at times to maybe influence him, but no real pressure. Today they put pressure on him. Oh my goodness, you can get pressure from any group. For example, we cater to all nationalities. And when we get a call, whether they have a dime or a donut, we go to work for them. We never buried any Jews in my dad's time. Rabbi was different. People would travel into Pittsburgh and make 4 or 5 trips into Pittsburgh. Now, we got a different young generation that grew up and said, we're tired of this running into Pittsburgh. Why can't we have the services here? So I was in Rotary Club, and we talked about it with a couple of Jewish friends of mine that were in the club. And I said, it's up to you people. We'll get together with a rabbi, and we'll tell you what we can do. We'll find out what you need, what you want. And I said, I know we can outdo your friends in Pittsburgh. And it saved a lot of time and inconvenience traveling. So sure enough, we buried 12, 18 Jewish persons here. And we saved them a tremendous amount of money. And the Jewish funeral homes, with the exception of one, they're all run by non-Jewish funeral directors and personnel. They're owned by, some of them are owned by Jewish families, but they have no management. One is even run by an Italian. So we have good rapport with everybody in the area. It seems as though people from different churches get in a habit of calling a certain funeral home, and then we're serving fourth generation now. We're the oldest established firm, continuous operation since 1940. We're third generation now, my son Michael. And we're burying people in their fourth generation. Every once in a while, I have someone come in and show us a picture of cemetery scene with the carriages lined up there. And point to one, that was your dad. He buried my grandma on St. Joe's Cemetery or Union Cemetery in Manac. And then in 1922, I think the Broadhead Road, Route 51, was paved. And that was a big attraction to use Mount Olivet Cemetery because it had paved the road out there. But Dad was a pioneer, and I'll take you in the room in a moment and I'll show you some of these old pictures, the equipment we had and what had. He started with horse and buggies, and I remember the first motor hearse that he had in 1930. I think it was 1930, it was probably 9 or 10 years old, and getting to the point where he had to get another car. And there was no trade-in guy in those days. When you see the car, you understand what I'm talking about. I can remember my dad watching me take that chassis and that body off of that hearse. And it was hand-carved with, they were taking crowbars and prying it off, destroying it. My dad stood there with tears coming out of his eyes. That was his first motor hearse, and had a lot of memories built into it, people that he'd served, what have you. But he was progressive. In fact, I even put that underneath the picture. He was a progressive person in his endeavor, in his profession. And he was the first to try the new, the last to give up the old. Yes, which is a good blend. And had, like the prayer to St. Anthony, you know the difference between what to do and what you can't do, and so on and so forth. But he had a vast experience. He was only 61 when he died. And he lived about 4 lifetimes at 61 with the experiences he had. And there's something about, you have to have a certain personality to be able to be in a profession, no matter what it is. You can be, think you'll be good at it. Maybe you're endowed, maybe you're talented. But your approach to the public is like a doctor that hasn't had good bedside manners. He might be a tremendous doctor, but he's really not accepted. Same as a funeral director, or even anyone in any profession. If they are talented and they can do their work, surround themselves with the right people, and they serve people properly, they're bound to be accepted. It's a traditional thing. We're serving families, as I said, third and fourth generation. And the new families we're serving, they more or less telling us in writing. They wish they had engaged us in former years, but they're getting a new experience. No, that's okay. So, I don't want to say that I have completely covered your subject here. In fact, there are a lot of things that if I'd done a little research, I could have been more, given you more of a contribution.
There are two more things I want to ask. Were you aware of how JNL was, how they were active in the community outside of the mill? Were there things that they sponsored or things that they did?
Yes. We have a park up here in Plan 12 that's called Morrell Park. When Admiral Ben Morrell was head of the works down here, the corporation had a heart. The corporation was a cold entity because they're aloof and away. But JNL, when they were asked for anything, they were building the town. And if you notice where most of the churches are, they were built on free ground. But JNL gave them a location. Not advantageous. For example, the Lutheran church was built on the corner up in a hill. Okay, and, it could have been in level ground in another place, but no, the level ground was worth more, and they built houses. The JNL Steel Company built all these homes, the Plan 12 and West Ellicott, Plan 7, Plan 11, so forth. And then they were sold at a very reasonable price to the workers, and that was one of the first things that they did. Come into the area and plan it. Each section was called a plan. Plan 8, Plan 7, Plan 6, and so on and so forth. And different ethnic groups got in on the ground floor and they would start to settle in that area. Like the black people went to Plan 11 and Plan 11 extension. And some of the groups went to West Ellicott because they wanted to walk to work. They didn't want to take the streetcar. West Ellicott was a town then before JNL came. Recreation area. It was a park down there. I can't remember what they called it. Woodlawn, probably Woodlawn. But there were always a West Dallas of it before JNL came in. And, they would contribute, they'd give to, well, they'd support a ball club, things like that. And then in our days, I think it started with Admiral Ben Morrell. Like they gave the ground to the Ellicott Hospital to build a new hospital. And that was a good gift. And they matched dollar for dollar for every dollar that we collected to sponsor the hospital. If I think they gave $1.5 million or something like that. So we had $3 million to start, plus the free ground. So they were good to the town, but the well is dried up. Now that's sold out to LTV. It's a coal corporation. They're firing, or they're forcing career men to retire early. They don't encourage. They don't encourage the men to really socialize or live in the community anymore. It used to be that the bosses had to live in the community and take a part in the community affairs. But with this corporation, LTV, just lost that warm feeling that we used to have. When JNL was owned by the stockholders in the Pittsburgh environs and around this area, we got a lot more cooperation for anything we had. But going back, the former works managers, they cooperated. Like I mentioned, in the garden that they had during wartime, the ground was donated by JNL. It took an empty lot and put it to production and fed people. Same thing during the war, Victory Garden. One way or another, they've enhanced the community, but it's not like, if I compare it to another town, U.S. Steel down in Middletown, Ohio, they've put up buildings, they've done tremendous things. And we saw the comparison, but that is a much larger plant. And, they started on a flat level area, which was very good and easy to build. Here we're building on hills and whatnot. But overall, I'd say JNL has been good to this town. When JNL actually ran the town in those days, and garbage collection was always on time. The borough equipment was clean and serviceable. The town was run by the steel plant, really, until the union came in and then the Democrats took over. We had, our streets were paved, we didn't have any potholes, so on and so forth. But then during the war, all of that was neglected because war effort was primary. And our town is, just hasn't expanded the way it should. And it's no longer desirable to live within the confines of tax structure. Development is getting very bad. They're tearing down buildings, they're losing that tax income, and the borough is always in trouble financially. So when someone comes to the area, they don't even consider living in downtown Ellicott or anywhere in the Ellicott area. For tax reasons, we're here. The borough line is right here, right on our property. We're in Hopewell, so our tax structure is different. But it just so happened that we spotted this ground, and I wasn't sure it was in the borough or not until we went to purchase. People had to expand. They get tired of these older homes and young people growing up. They want to have a ranch-style home, and it's good for older people. They don't be climbing steps all the time. Okay. But to expand, they had to go to Hopewell Center, Raccoon, Independence, and so forth. So I couldn't make any statement other than say that JNL in its whole history has been good to Alcott. It could have been better. Had this last merger and stock sale not taken place. But I know very many career men that quit early. Some were even released. And it was a terrible shock to them. One man wanted to work the next 10 months and he could go into retirement. And he was released. And they bring in people from the outside that have no feeling for the community. And that's not good. Overall, my statement is JNL as a corporation is always good to the community.
You said that the churches have not real good land. The types is right in the middle.
They probably bought it. And I was in on a picture there also when Father's Honor was looking for a new location. The bishop encouraged him to buy in another area before we build our church. And we tried to buy the ground. It was owned by the JNL land company, Woodlawn Land Company. And another person made an offer lower than ours and accepted it. It's now a shopping center. But it would have been ideal for a parish. Oh, it was beautiful, beautiful ground. And it could have been adequate parking and so on and so forth. But it just didn't materialize. So St. Titus is split. We now have St. Francis Cabrini, which emanated from St. Titus, and there's Our Lady of Fatima on the other side, and in fact, there may be another church established near Hokestown soon to serve that community out there, but there's no Catholic church in that particular vicinity. They have to go into West Virginia or Ohio, but I can remember a lot of experiences.
When you were in school, do you recall any kind of separation of the ethnic groups?
No, not a real separation. Like, there were cliques always, little friendship groups of people were friendly to each other. But we played ball. Everybody played ball. If we had a disagreement, I can remember. When an Italian boy couldn't speak English very well. And for some reason or other, he took a liking to me, and I started teaching him words. And he wasn't allowed to play in a group because he couldn't really handle the language. So finally, I picked up a group to play ball against another group, and we got a game going, and somebody claimed that we had an out, we didn't have an out, and we got into a wrestling engagement there. And boy had me down on the ground and started to push my shoulders down. This big Italian boy, he stepped, pulled him off. So kids will always have spats, you know how it is, but there was no outright bigotry, or we didn't look down upon them. Well, every once in a while, they tease them, you know, and to to a kid that didn't know his lessons and was having trouble. It might call him dummy now and then, or dunce or something like that. But that same kid would come through with something else, and then they were sorry they said that word. But I don't think there was any outright animosity toward any other group.
Were there any things that the different ethnic groups did that was special, that you put on or anything that you shared?
Yes, when they had a bake sale for the benefit of the church or the school, they would come in with fantastic contributions. Or if they would have a spaghetti dinner, the Italian ladies would come in and help prepare it, and the other ladies would help serve it and what have you. But everyone had a little specialty contribution of one type or another. And handmade things, a lot of people made handmade quilts and doilies and things like that, lace work and what have you. And some people were better at it than others. But it's just like the choir. The choir was made up of probably a cross-section of everybody in the parish. Boys choir, we always had a good boys choir, and then the men's choir. They call it men, but they finally got women. It's called men's choir for a long time. Now there's the choir at St. Titus has about 50-50. The ladies attend and go to the rehearsal, and the men are always too busy. But they want to sing in a choir on Sundays. But, yeah, this was a tremendous community at one time. I'd say it was a good place to raise a family. Time has taken attrition. It's just not a fertile field now to bring up a family in the confines of the Aliquip area. Suburbs are a little bit better. There are programs going on. Children have a tremendous opportunity today, from all age groups. There are more sports, there's more activities for them, school activities. There's academic challenges today, and opportunities will be there when this generation growing up now, they'll be able to move into those openings. In fact, we just attended a wedding, and the bride and the groom were both hired as engineers in a very, very good company. But it's out of the area, but they took the examination, and they were accepted as a husband and wife team. That was another point my dad often said. He regretted one way of coming to the Aliquip area because we only have one industry. We have a couple small plants in West Aliquip, but they don't contribute as far as hiring people. They're a small specialty company. They don't have much influence on the community. Years ago they did. In fact, we used to have a mill down in West Aliquip that made shovels for steel mills and mining and farmers. One of our retired employees used to work there as a young boy. We had a specialty steel company in West Aliquip that did beautifully during the war years. But now they're importing so much specialty steel. The demand has gone down. And if you're in a community that only has one commercial venture in manufacturing, when that goes down, the whole town takes on a sour note.
I wonder why.
Well, J&L bought all the land. They owned from South Heights to Manac. And to be on the water in those days was to get their product out by water and by rail. And now they build plants inland, like the new Volkswagen plant is not on a great shipping area, but they truck so much today. And I would say that even the railroad freight has gone down to a very low ebb, because they can get it there quicker and get there overnight by truck. And rail takes days longer. But during the war, they did a lot of shipping by rail. But every community is a little distinct, a little different in their endeavor to make the surrounding fine for families. Certain areas you wouldn't want to live there because there's too much industrialized area. But I would have to say that at the reunions that I attend, people say, well, we were lucky. We had we were here in a good time. Time now aren't so good, but you have to have a happy outlook and say, well, someday the economy bounces, we're going to bounce back, and we will have a steel mill here. Provided the demand for that product comes back, then we'll have employment, but it will never reach the peak it did in wartime. And you have to go along with that. You have to realize that it changes.
Thank you very much. I don't have more specific questions.
Go ahead.
You
have nothing?
Have
I'm sorry. Okay. I just feel a little bit badly I couldn't come up with these other names. Your application is the influence of the nuns in the community, and a blanket statement would be that they were most welcome. You couldn't have a school in those days without the nuns' dedication. And, the church could never afford to pay salaries like they're gleaning today, and they're entitled to them. A person spends the money on an education. They're specialty people. They should be recognized. They have a tremendous influence on the community. And as soon as a child leaves a mother's knee, we rely on the teachers to take over. And we're always cautious, especially in advanced education, about recommending people to go to pursue a college career in certain colleges because of their attitude toward life in the 80s. There's no two ways about it. Anyone that matriculated from Catholic basic school, secondary, college has an edge on everybody else. Well, definitely, there's no two ways about it. And it always shows up. It showed up in our career when we were in school. Just the attitude of the students when we were in a bombing college in Pittsburgh. You could always tell the ones that they actually had a good study habit, and their behavior was a lot more, exemplary than some of the others. The rowdy ones, you always have a few rowdies, but some of them got out of hand in one way or another. It all goes back, like I said, to basic training. Just like right now, I have a lot of friends. I know a few words in Greek. I get along with the Greek families. I know a few in Italian. I get along fine with that. I know a few in Slovak. In fact, the man at work for us was supposed to give me 10 words a day in conversation that I could use. And it's just like the classic Greek. Nobody understands when I use the classic Greek. Okay. But we did a favor for a man the other day. All we did was send to Ohio to get a certificate for him so that he could settle some property. He came in, paid the $5 charge, and turned around back, and we had a package. He handed me a bottle of specialty Greek whiskey, which is a fine gesture on his part. That's not necessary. Well, no, you did me a favor. Nobody else could do it. So they nicknamed me Demetrius. That's my Greek name. Okay. So we get along fine with them. And then, for the Italians, my name is Vincenzo Giuseppe Antonio Duraccio. So I've been adopted. And then every once in a while, a Lebanese people, and we have a Lebanese funeral. We go over to the hall and say, Jim, you're always here when we have a sad time. How about coming? We have a hafla. Okay, you dedicate it to me and I'll come. It's a happy time. But you have to be outgoing and, in a community like this. We're exposed to all of these people. We try to make them feel friendly and wanted. And we don't try to overstep our bounds. Make ourselves available to try to help them. We gained a lot, we gleaned a lot of experience in serving people.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Yes. Sister, I'd like to mention also in reading Dr. A.J. Cronin's books, he's a very great Scotch author, and he was a medical doctor. Later in life, he wrote these very fine books. And, in reading one day, I came across a paragraph, and the descriptive language went that it was a beautiful sight in the fall of the year to stand at the foot of Darik Mountain and to look up and see the various colored trees showing their fall splendor. That's on page 68, paragraph 1, left-hand side, third line.
Of what book?
I forgot the name of the book. It's A.J. Cronin. I'll give it to you, though.
Okay. And this was in the town where your father was born?
In Kilmarnock. No, it wasn't definitely in Kilmarnock. It was another village. It was another village. He probably couldn't allude to that town of Kilmarnock. It was in one of his other stories, but the mountain was our name. And my aunt Dolly's a retired school teacher, and she's writing a history of the family. So I gave her the book. I'll have to find out the title of that.
Conclude again.
Sure, okay.